First off, let me thank everybody for joining us today and express my sincere hope that everybody is well in this environment. You know, it's very important we take care of each other and that we also take care of ourselves. And at the same time, try to soldier on as best as we can. And, you know, obviously, if there's anything that we can do as a larger community to help each other, I think that's something that we should definitely lean in and do as quickly and as well as we can. In addition, I'd like to welcome, as Sasha has mentioned, two terrific people who were absolutely instrumental in helping us get to the result in Shabakuki. Bill Chandler, who litigated the matter. Bill, for those of you who don't know him, is the former chancellor of the Delaware Court of Chancery. Bill, would you say hi?
Hello to everyone.
There you go. And then a force of nature, Priyar Huskins, who is a insurance broker with Woodruff Sawyer. She really was the force behind the scenes. And in many different ways, a lot of this litigation would not have been able to happen without Priya's active involvement. Priya, just a few words.
Good morning, everybody.
There you go. So our systems are up and working. I'm just going to talk through two more slides that help animate the reason for the creation of federal forum provisions. And then we'll get to a discussion about Shabakuki and the Delaware Supreme Court's opinion itself. So if you have a look at this mean retention slide, the main message here is that D&O insurance has become crazy expensive relative to where it was in 2015. And I'm going to ask Priya to kick in with a couple of observations because she's in this market every day. If you have a look at the mean retention back in 2015, all right, according to these data, it was $2 million. Today, that retention is running $8 million. And remember, this is the average. So you actually have companies out there with retentions significantly above that amount. Priya, can you give us a little bit more background about what you're seeing on the retention side of pricing and IPOs now?
So you have on the chart data that goes through the second quarter of 2019. And this is something you can imagine that we have tracked very carefully for our companies. Woodruff Sawyer is a market leader when it comes to D&O insurance for IPO. So we have great data on this phenomenon. What I can tell you is that the deals we were pricing in the first quarter of this year, and obviously I don't think it's going to be a surprise to hear that most IPOs are on hold at this point, but the mean retention has continued to go up since the timing of the slide you're showing, Joe, looking at $15 and $20 million self-insured retentions. And that is regardless of the size of the offering. So imagine being a life science company or planning to raise $100 million, and I roll in and tell you that, well, that's great that you're going to raise money for research, but you actually are looking at, let's call it a $15 million self-insured retention that you need to think about because of the probability of being sued. That's untenable for those companies.
Yeah. So what we have is a quadrupling in the retention since 2015. And Priya is telling us it's now more than a quadruple. Then if we have a look at the premium, the amount you've got to pay per $1 million, all right, that too has almost quadrupled since the 2015 level. Initially about $197,000. Now $768,000. So simply put, D&O insurance is really expensive relative to where it was before. Priya, what are we seeing on the premium numbers?
So the way we think about it with clients right now is that pretty much anybody that wants to have a reasonable amount of limit, and let's all agree that we're going to buy less insurance the higher the self-insured retention is, right? Because you just the exposure is only so much. The guidance we're giving clients, you know, most people who want to be, let's say, just a mid-market public company is $3 to $5 million. And what has been very difficult is the ability to predict quarter to quarter what the price will be, because, of course, the change has been rapid and steep.
Yeah. And let me also just remind all the participants, you know, Priya, Bill, and I are very happy to respond to your questions. And the best way is there's a Q&A feature and there's also a chat feature. We're monitoring all of those. So if anybody has a question, if they want more clarification, if they'd like Priya to address various issues, you know, in the D&O market or the like, it would be terrific to be able to respond to any of your questions or anything on the chat. Some additional data. Oh, that was the one slide that we had on that. Priya, while I load the next slide, do you want to share some observations about your thoughts as to whether Shabakuki will change this market?
Yeah, so we all, of course, are delighted to see a mitigation strategy for this situation. You can only imagine, and I'm sure many of the people on the line have been in these conversations where management and boards of directors were completely beside themselves about the fact that we had this situation and how can we afford it. You can imagine those conversations. Of course, now people want to know how quickly will insurance carriers drop pricing, and it's not going to be fast. And so here are a few observations. One of the things to remember is that as terrible as the situation has been for Section 11 litigation against IPO companies, that is not the only issue that was driving pricing in the market. Cornerstone has great data, Woodruff Sawyer has great data that demonstrates that the frequency and severity of these suits has been up in terms of frequency, pretty much a doubling of the rate of public companies being sued from the beginning of the decade compared to the end. Derivative suits, also a shock to the system, and that is all in the face of having had about a decade of lowering D&O insurance prices. So while I think we could all agree
the D&O, allow me to interrupt just a second. The D&O settlements lately, there have been several well over $100 million, and this is an area where the insurers aren't used to writing checks that large for those types of claims. You might want to expand a minute or two in terms of explaining to the audience why this is yet another factor to worry about.
Thank you, Joe. So consider the derivative suits we've seen lately, American Realty, McKesson. Last year we had Wells Fargo, a number in a short period of time of very large settlements of derivative suits. For a D&O insurance program, settlements of derivative suits are paid under what's called the Side A insuring agreement. And traditionally, given the paucity of large derivative suit settlements, carriers have been pretty content to not charge very much for that kind of insurance, that Side A portion of the insurance. And when you think then about the change that we're seeing with these very large settlements, you know, an observation that I can make is that if you are any of these companies that did disclose that they paid these settlements only with insurance, remember that derivative suit settlements for Delaware companies cannot be indemnified. Now, those companies have disclosed that insurance paid those settlements. Now, think about it from a carrier's position. Let's say you were charging $30,000 for $10 million of coverage on a high excess tower because, frankly, you just didn't think Wells Fargo would ever have a settlement of this size. You have to sell a lot of insurance policies to make up for that $10 million if you're only charging $30,000 for that limit. So that by itself is a shock. So this is all to say that we do hope to see D&O insurance prices lower, particularly for IPOs. It will not be at 2015 levels, is my prediction. The other issue, and I know Joe will talk about this, is that the Delaware outcome is great, and it's not the end of the story. Insurance carriers will be asking the question, well, what does this mean in practice? Does it really work? Those kinds of issues. So it's a tremendous step forward, Shabakuki's outcome. It is not the only thing. The last thing I want to say, or another comment I want to make, however, is that it is my hope that all companies thinking about doing an IPO start changing their articles or certificates of incorporation to take advantage of this. I do believe that just like with state choice of forum provisions, insurance carriers will start asking for and expecting that federal choice of forum provisions are part of the package of the risk they are underwriting.
So Priya's actually anticipated a point that I was going to make. As a result of this session, every single one of you is going to have a reason to call every publicly traded client you have and say, we need to talk about a federal forum provision as a bylaw. All right. And we'll get to this question in a second, and we're going to pull the chancellor into that. I just want to answer two of the questions that have come in on Q&A and encourage people, please, to ask these questions. We want to hear from you. We want to answer. So there's a question as to whether there's been a trend in D&O limits, upward or downward. What are you hearing on that, Priya?
So on the one hand, looking at the litigation landscape, clients very much would like to increase their limits, particularly around that Side A I was talking about that can be put on a program in addition to the regular coverage, so extra Side A. And the trend towards increasing limits is absolutely being throttled back by two factors. The first is these higher self-insured retentions I've mentioned. We talked about how high they are for IPO companies. They are also going up for mature public companies. So to the extent somebody thought, gosh, I need $5 million more in limit, I often point out that actually you have a much higher retention than you used to. So the total coverage being afforded for the exposure doesn't warrant, based on the numbers, doesn't warrant more in limit. The other issue, though, is that it is so expensive. Even in mature public companies, we have seen increases ranging from 10%, 20%. And for some foreign filers, it was 400% last year. That has to do with the dynamics of the London market with foreign filers particularly. But where I'm going with this is it doesn't actually matter what your price was before. That was the price that management was basically expecting year over year. So whether it's 20% or much more, it is a surprise to companies unless they've been getting good information ahead of time, and it makes them very reluctant to increase their limit.
So let's move on now to a discussion of the opinion in Shabakuki. So the opinion in Shabakuki, Bill, are you there?
Yes, I am, Joe.
Fantastic. The first thing that we really need to resolve, and this is extraordinarily important, it's the correct pronunciation of Shabakuki. And you know, Bill had a very hard time pronouncing Shabakuki for a while. You remember this, Bill? Until I
yes,
said,
I did. Look.
Yeah, it's really, what you got to do is you got to break it down into two separate words. There's Shaba and there's Kuki. All right. So Shabakuki, all right, is the simple way. Bill, you also have trouble with Matsushita, but that's a separate conversation. and let me just say, Bill did an absolutely masterful job litigating this matter before the Delaware Supreme Court. As you can imagine, we had several moots. There was a strategy that was involved, and it was a masterful oral argument, pieces of which are actually cited in the opinion. And, you know, you couldn't ask for more than a 5-0 result. Just really absolutely the best. The other thing to point out is the cornerstone data is cited extensively by the Delaware Supreme Court. It was absolutely essential in terms of explaining to the world that this is not a gratuitous provision being added to corporate charters. It's a very rational provision designed to address a real world problem that's causing real expense for companies that are going public. So the bottom line of the opinion here, from my perspective, very simply, is federal forum provisions work. They're entirely valid under Delaware law. The plaintiffs liked calling these provisions the Grundfest solution to the problem that Priya described in terms of exploding insurance rates and the migration from federal to state court. From a very simple practitioner's perspective, there's a view where the only thing you need to know is that federal forum provisions work, and you can stick them in the charters, you can stick them in the bylaws. There'll be issues to resolve later on. This is not a one and done, but you should be comfortable under Delaware law sticking them in your organic documents. Bill, what's your perspective on that?
Well, I agree with you, Joe. I refer to this really as the Grundfos solution 2.0, because you actually had an earlier solution to the earlier problem of multi-forum litigation involving state law claims. And that was litigated in the Court of Chancery back in 2014 and 15. And we worked together on that one. And we got the Boilermakers decision that effectively found valid the use of bylaws or charter provisions to steer state law claims into the state of jurisdiction, in most cases, Delaware. And that case was referred to a lot in this more recent Grundfos solution, the 2.0 solution, as I call it, to the federal forum problem following Cyan and following the numbers that you had on the screen about the multiplication of lawsuits all over the place. So I want to give you credit for coming up with both solutions. And I want to thank Priya and the insurers for providing the ability to litigate this case all the way through the appeal. Without Priya and her team, it wouldn't have been possible to pursue the appeal, and we wouldn't have gotten this terrific result. And I want to also thank the companies, Stitch Fix, Roku, and Blue Apron. I mean, these defendants stuck with this. They could have easily mooted this case by just agreeing not to enforce these provisions and save themselves a lot of time and money, or they could have just agreed to pay a fee at the end of the litigation in Chancery and move on from that. They didn't. They agreed to stand and fight and went forward with the appeal. And just like Chevron and FedEx back in 2014 and 15, who stood their ground and fought to defend the validity of the actions they'd taken, this is going to have, I think, a tremendous impact going forward. Because like you, Joe, I think these provisions are going to now be used in charter provisions and companies going public. And pre-IPO clients ought to be counseled carefully on how to do that. And then companies that are already existing companies in secondary offerings should be counseled about the best way to do this. I think bylaws will work. I think there's plenty of language in the opinion that would indicate that the court doesn't see a difference between a bylaw provision and a charter provision. So I agree with you full-heartedly on all of that.
Yeah, so 109 and 102 as a practical matter, I don't think there's any daylight between them, given the breadth and the strength of the opinion that was issued over here. You know, there'll be all sorts of technical questions about exactly how you want to write the provision. But, you know, it just in terms of, you know, being safe, we know that the wording that was actually used in these cases is fine with Delaware. So point one, keep that wording or make as few changes as you think necessary and appropriate. You know, another perspective that I'd share is if you look at the style of the opinion, this is, in my view, a huge victory for a textualist approach. And it's clear that the court gave a very, very close reading to the text of the Delaware Code, and it didn't make stuff up. You know, with all due respect, lower court and chancery made stuff up. It made statements of fact that were less than fully supportable. It made statements of law that were inconsistent with controlling precedent. And it's almost, from my perspective, refreshing to read the Supreme Court's opinion and compare and contrast with the opinion below. Bill, do you have any perspectives on you know, that kind of question relating to judicial style?
Well, I think the Supreme Court's opinion is, as you said, it's a very carefully crafted opinion, very well written by Justice Valahura on behalf of the Supreme Court. It approaches the problem in sort of the classic traditional way, I think, of looking carefully at what does the statutory language actually provide, and reading that language consistent with the way it's been interpreted historically. And she goes about that in a very careful and methodical way. And I think that's the classic example of a Delaware Supreme Court opinion. So I give total accolades to the court for the way it proceeded to analyze the problem and then answer the question that was put to it.
Yeah. You know, and if you read the opinion, I think you can boil down the message into a relatively small number of points. You know, one, in a certain sense, is the words of the statute mean exactly what they say. right? 102B1 means what it says, and there's no secret first principle that is knowable outside the text of the statute and that otherwise constrains 102B1. All right. The other important interpretive point is that 102B1 isn't constrained by Section 115. 115, very complicated. Bill, why don't you just take a second and explain the origin of 115, how it came about because of the Boilermakers decision, and what the consequences might have been if 115 was viewed as constraining 102.
Well, starting with the latter point, if the court had viewed 115 as limiting or imposing some constraint or restriction on 102, we would have had a very different outcome, I'm afraid. And fortunately, the court did not buy that argument at all. 115's origins really are traceable back to an earlier decision of the Supreme Court known as ATP, in which the Supreme Court had found that in a non-stock corporation, a bylaw or charter provision that purported to shift fees to the losing party in intra-corporate litigation was enforceable and valid under Delaware law. That decision led to some turmoil within the corporate bar about whether fee shifting was appropriate. And the upshot of that was that the corporate law council drafted Section 115 and also an amendment to 102 and 109 that effectively prohibited fee shifting in corporate litigation involving internal affairs claims or internal corporate claims. 115, as a compromise to that, I think, codified the Boilermakers decision. 115 basically said, if a company is going to litigate an internal affairs claim, it can choose Delaware, but it can't choose any other state. It has to choose Delaware for an internal corporate claim. And so that was 115's real thrust, was emphasizing that you had to choose Delaware and you couldn't choose another state. And at the same time, you couldn't have fee shifting. So that was sort of the gist of what Section 115 was all about. And in this litigation, there was some argument that 115 impliedly, not expressly, but impliedly amended 102's breadth of scope of how broadly you could draft a charter provision and that it would effectively impliedly prohibit a federal forum provision because it was saying the only forum provision you can have is one that chooses Delaware. But the Supreme Court, you know, saw through that argument and realized that it just was not the way you interpret statutes. A later in time statute that's more narrowly drafted doesn't impliedly reverse or constrain an earlier statute that's more broadly written unless it does so expressly. And the legislature knew how to say things expressly. If they wanted to change 102 and its breadth, they could have said so clearly, but they didn't. They did say in one section of 102 that you couldn't have fee shifting in internal corporate claims as defined in 115. The fact that the legislature could say that so clearly and crisply in 102 undercut the legs of the argument that they had impliedly meant to overrule the breadth of 102 and constrain it in the way the plaintiffs were arguing here. So that's a long-winded way, Joe, I'm afraid, of trying to explain how 115 here was really critical to the outcome. And the whole construct of our argument, as you know, because you helped craft it, was that limiting feature of 115 could not be applied in that way. And that's what got the Supreme Court's attention, and they agreed with it. And that's the outcome that we got was really, that was the turning point.
Yeah. And, you know, I think that's right. And the other thing that I think is fair to say is that 115 is very complicated. There was a huge dispute as to what it meant and how it was to be interpreted. And I think some of the most careful legal reasoning that Bill and I had to work through to figure out how to argue this case and present it was precisely how to navigate with 115 and how to explain what 115 did and didn't. I'm going to go to some questions. We have two questions from the audience, but before we go to that, You know, just a small point about drafting. I'm going to try to focus on what you, the listeners and participants in this conference, can actually do to help your clients in this context. One of the issues about 115 is, in my view, it's important always to leave open the possibility that a Section 11 claim, even though you're going to direct it to federal court, in order to avoid issues under 115, you always leave open the opportunity for people to file in Delaware. All right, Bill, do you agree with that?
Yes, I do. I think that would be helpful if it enabled you to file in Delaware as well. So that would perhaps blunt the argument.
Yeah, so it's exactly right. So when you look at the text of the provisions at issue in Shabakuki, what you'll see is that I wrote a clause right at the beginning, basically, which operates as a fiduciary out, all right, unless the company decides otherwise. What that means is that if a plaintiff decides to bring a Section 11 claim in Delaware court, and it wouldn't be in Chancery because it's a claim for money damages. Is that right, Bill?
Yeah, that's correct.
Okay, so you would be, a plaintiff would have to be filing not in Chancery, but in Delaware Superior Court, and they'd be seeking money damages under Section 11 in order to avoid an issue under 115. The corporation may have to consent to have that litigation move forward in Delaware, even though the primary thrust of the federal forum provision is to have the litigation in federal court. Bill, is that consistent with your interpretation of the opinion?
I think you can read the opinion that way. I don't think the Supreme Court views 115 as a vehicle by which Securities Act claims would be brought in Delaware state courts. They are, I think, pretty clearly of the view that what the legislature had in mind in 115 is Delaware law claims that fit within the classic definition of the internal affairs doctrine, and that that's what has to be brought in Delaware, and that federal claims really fall outside of that and weren't intended to be covered by 115. But I understand your drafting thoughts, Joe, and I think that could be used in the fashion you're describing.
Yes, because there will be additional litigation when you actually have one of these provisions and you're actually going to the claim on an as-applied basis. That goes to one of the questions we have. Let's try to respond to some of these. Federal forum provisions don't violate federal law or policy or Delaware law or policy. We now know that from Shabakuki. Here's the question. Any thoughts as to whether they violate California or New York law or policy? And let me expand. Do they violate the policy of any state? You know, Bill, you and I have had conversations about that, and why don't you kick that off?
Well, I'll just say that, you know, I'm not conversant with every state's law, but I just simply don't know of any state's public policy that would be offended by a federal forum provision. And as Joe said, they're clearly not contrary to any federal law or federal policy. The Rodriguez decision, I think, makes that very clear. So I'm hard-pressed to think of any state law, but there may be some state law or policy out there that I'm unaware of, but I doubt it.
Yeah, Bill, I'm with you entirely, and I think the answer is really very simple. And that is, what is legitimate state interest? Where is the state policy to prevent a federal claim being litigated in federal court when the statute expressly permits federal court litigation? And if you're trying to keep litigation simply in that state, you go across the street to the federal courthouse, you know, which is typically located real near the state courthouse. So the most aggressive intrastate let's capture litigation a statute that I'm aware of is in Idaho, and that statute declaring a policy in Idaho to keep that litigation in Idaho does not go so far, wouldn't even touch that. So, you know, I'm sure the argument is going to come up. Anybody can make any argument, but I would be looking forward to the argument that there's something fundamentally unfair about litigating or it's against the state policy to litigate a federal claim in a federal court where they've been litigated for decades. That'll be a fun argument to make because it's going to get quoted in federal court where this is going to wind up anyway. There's another question we have, and that's, do you foresee this decision as creating a conflict with federal law in the sense that the Securities Act creates concurrent jurisdiction in state and federal courts for Securities Act violations? Bill, this is Rodriguez. Why don't you take that?
Sure. I mean, you brought Rodriguez to me, Joe, so you know as well as I do that the United States Supreme Court has already said that in the context of a federal law that gives concurrent jurisdiction to both state courts and federal courts, you can use a forum selection provision. The Rodriguez case actually was a brokerage agreement that included an arbitration provision. And they said that was akin to a forum selection provision. And so the Supreme Court sees no imperative that you have to have both forums available, and parties can agree to select one of the two available forums. And the most logical one, because it's the one where the most experience exists, they are the courts that have the comparative advantage, it seems to me, in litigating federal claims, are federal courts. And the beauty of the Grunfest solution is that these provisions are written so it's any federal court. And so I don't see how that's going to create a conflict with federal law or federal policy.
Yeah, to me, one of the most remarkable things about this whole litigation is the Supreme Court's opinion in Rodriguez. Rodriguez holds clearly that plaintiffs have no immutable right to litigate in state court, even though the statute clearly creates concurrent jurisdiction. That means that forum selection provisions can operate notwithstanding the existence of concurrent jurisdiction. Now, you know how many times the defendants, the plaintiffs in this case actually cited to Rodriguez, even though it was controlling precedent? Zero. All right. They ran from Rodriguez. Basically, in all of their briefing, extraordinarily important Supreme Court precedent gets mentioned never. All right. You say Rodriguez and they react like it's Dracula in the room. Rodriguez is absolutely, totally, irrevocably fatal to huge parts of plaintiff's analysis. And the only way they approached it was to say, well, let's ignore controlling precedent from the United States Supreme Court. I try to teach my students not to do that, or at least not to do that as blatantly as the plaintiffs did in this case. So you know, Rodriguez is I think, you know, very important as a practical matter in terms of what's going on here. Bill, let's take another question. And here, it observes the decision is relevant to 33 Act claims. If a Delaware publicly traded company isn't contemplating a securities offering in the foreseeable future, are there other considerations or reasons why they should be adopting such a provision now? I'll give you a quick answer. It's not going to hurt. It's like chicken soup. All right. You don't want to forget about it later on. It's front of mind now. The way I look at it is there's no downside. So if there's no downside, it's going to act as, you know, potential insurance. It might help you get a lower rate on your insurance policy, you know, at some point in the future. So I don't see how doing that would actually hurt in the current environment. Bill?
I tend to agree, although with a little more hesitation. I think if I were going to do it, I'd probably do it in a bylaw, not in a charter provision, because bylaws are easier to change than charter provisions are. Secondly, I mean, to the extent that other federal claims other than 33 Act claims might be implicated, I think that's out beyond the scope of what this decision from the Delaware Supreme Court is focused on and addressing. I wouldn't want to.
Yeah, and the 34 Act has exclusive federal jurisdiction, so this doesn't come up in the context of 10b-5 claims.
Correct. I just am very reluctant to talk about any federal claims other than 33 Act claims, which was the specific focus in this case.
I agree entirely. Then we've got another question. What recourse does a defendant have if a state court outside of Delaware decides to disagree with Shabakuki?
So you want me to go first, Joe?
Yeah, I've got my answer.
Well, I, Well, first I'd answer it with, you know, based on past history, namely the Chevron and FedEx decision, which sometimes referred to as the Boilermakers decision back in 2015, one of the big questions after that decision, which wasn't a Delaware Supreme Court decision, it was a Court of Chancery decision by then Chancellor Strine, there were questions about whether other states would honor or respect that decision and enforce forum selection provisions that sent litigation involving internal claims to Delaware. The history has shown that states have, in fact, honored and respected that decision and have enforced forum selection provisions of that kind. So my hope, and also I think my prediction, is that other states will, in fact, enforce this decision in the same manner, because it really is not a threat to other jurisdictions, because it enforces a federal claim in a federal court that it seems to me to not be threatening to other states. But to the extent that another state court declined to follow it, then I don't know the answer other than you can appeal that decision. And if they have a basis on finding the forum provision somehow unreasonable on an as-applied basis, then it might be a problem. But I think that's going to be a difficult challenge and a difficult argument.
Yeah. So, Bill, I could imagine a couple of California judges in court saying, no, we're not going to pay attention to Delaware's interpretation of Delaware law. It's a California headquartered corporation. We have other provisions. We have other public policy interests. And there you go. I would disagree with that strongly, but I'm not going to tell you it's not going to happen. And if it does happen, let's take it to the Supreme Court. It'll be another decision where we have to look at the internal affairs doctrine, which you can either view as a constitutional provision or you can view it as a choice of law provision. But one way or another, the United States Supreme Court is going to have to decide whether Delaware law controls this or whether you have two masters, the state in which you're headquartered and the state of your incorporation. When we get to the Supreme Court as currently constituted on this issue, if it ever gets there, I think everybody can guess where I would bet the outcome would be, and I would be thrilled to litigate that matter. That will be an easy one. Let's take another question here. I like firewalls between federal securities law and state corporate law. Shabakuki doesn't see high walls. Aren't you concerned that Delaware disclosure law, fiduciary relationships giving rise to a generalized duty to disclose all material information, will further seep into federal law where it's already infected 14A? Bill?
I defer, Joe. I didn't hear the question completely, but if it's talking about whether Delaware disclosure law is going to now filter into federal, I don't see that as a likely outcome of this decision.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think what we have here is a situation where Delaware law and federal law have coexisted for a long time. And the extent to which there's been seepage from Delaware into federal, under my impression, really has not been that large. And most of the seepage that I see actually goes in the opposite direction in terms of derivative claims arising because of federal claims. We now have another question that I think is very astute and demonstrates a careful reading of the Shabakuki opinion. But it says, but doesn't the opinion say Section 11 claims are not internal affairs claims? Bill? Because you and I have been back and forth on this.
Yeah, I think it does. I think the court does say that federal claims under Section 11 are not internal affairs claims because they don't arise under Delaware law. They arise under federal law. So a federal forum provision, though, can, to the extent it's steering federal claims to federal courts, is an intra-corporate claim. That is a claim that it isn't internal. It doesn't arise under Delaware law. It arises under federal law, but it's an intra-corporate issue that involves the relationship of directors, stockholders, and officers of the company, much in the very same sense that an internal affairs claim does. And frequently, those claims intersect. I mean, you can have federal claims under Section 11 and have it the same simultaneously. You can have Delaware claims on breach of fiduciary duty and disclosure issues that are very similar, rising out of the same facts. So there is a distinction, and I think the Supreme Court recognizes it. And I think the graph they drew, you know, helps emphasize that they see the difference.
Yeah. So this really requires, I think, some fine parsing of language and law. And this is just really a great and very important question that the Supreme Court appears to be saying Section 11, qua Section 11, is not an internal claim, and you're not regulating that under Delaware law. But the question of where the claim is going to be litigated is an intra-corporate claim that is governed by Delaware law under 102B1, all right? And only Delaware can decide that. Is that a fair articulation, Bill?
It is, and I agree with it.
Okay. So we will get to the Venn diagram, and we'll then ask whether the Venn diagram properly conveys that distinction. I've got some concerns, and I think the question that just came in did a good job of pointing in that direction. If we go back to the slide, all right, we observe the Supreme Court saying that the federal forum provisions don't violate the policies or laws of Delaware. Also, they don't violate the policy or a federal policy or law. It also makes the point there's only one definition of internal affairs. And, you know, one of the things that I found really remarkable about Chancery's opinion here was that Chancery sought to create a separate definition of internal affairs that has no precedent. And it just went totally off the reservation. And it didn't even cite controlling United States or Delaware Supreme Court precedent about how you define internal affairs. It just made stuff up. And I remember reading, you know, Chancery's opinion in Chabukuki, getting to that part and going, what's happening here? I mean, how did this happen? Other very interesting part of the opinion, I think, is footnote 169. And to me, it's kind of fascinating that it gets slipped in at the very end. And it's almost like a footnote that's hanging off of text. And you almost don't need it over there. But I think it's clear the court wanted to get that opinion in, get it into the opinion. And it basically says that because of the text of Section 115, mandatory arbitration would not be valid, would not be a valid provision under Delaware law. Bill, you want to speak to that?
Sure. I think this was sort of the concern the court had, that people believed, and perhaps even the trial court in its decision, thinking that this decision on the federal forum provision would somehow be a slippery slope, and that the next step on that slope would be mandatory arbitration provisions in bylaws or charters for all shareholder litigation. And so I think the Supreme Court wanted to allay concerns about that, and they did it in the footnote 169 by pointing out that, you know, this seemed to be a concern, and much of the opposition to these federal forum provisions might have been driven by this concern about arbitration being the next step in the process. And so the court went out of its way, I think, to just make it clear that that's an irrational concern, because under 115, the provision makes it clear that, and the synopsis to the legislative history to 115 makes it clear that that is intended to preclude or bar arbitration forums from being selected. You can select Delaware courts, you can't select other state courts, and you can't select arbitration as a forum. And that, I think, puts to rest that fear or concern that might have been driving this.
You know, I agree with you entirely, Bill. And you know, I got to tell you, when the plaintiffs, you know, came up with that argument, I thought they were, to be polite, nuts. I thought they were odd because, number one, a federal forum provision basically says you can't arbitrate this. You have to take it to federal court. So if every publicly traded corporation adopted a federal forum provision, there would be absolutely zero possibility of arbitrating any of these claims. So the plaintiffs really had to say up is down, left is right, in is out, just nuts. Do you see?
Not really, Joe. Not really. Okay. I mean, I get your point. Yeah, this is like an anti-arbitration provision. But there, I think their fear was, okay, if you allow this, then you are going to be signaling to the corporate world, okay, come back next time and ask for a charter or a bylaw provision that it requires arbitration of shareholder claims, and we'll get that approved. So I just think they were thinking that's the next step.
Yes, you're absolutely right. So if you look at it from a micro perspective, which is the first way that I was looking at it, any corporation that does the federal forum provision is in effect saying, we're not going to arbitrate this. Then if you look at it macro perspective, which addresses the point that you're raising, if you interpret Section 115 according to its terms and according to the legislative history, the synopsis, I think it's entirely clear that it covers, all right, what's going on in federal forum provisions. And because it says you must allow for litigation, it mandatory arbitration. So 115 solves that problem from that perspective. Is that how you see it, Bill?
Yep, I agree with you totally on that, Joe.
Right. So mandatory arbitration of 33 Act claims is now dead and buried, all right, in Delaware. And that, as a collateral matter, solves a whole bunch of problems for the SEC in terms of a lot of their policies. Now, what happens in other states, totally different question. You know, Bill and I can't solve every problem in the world in one morning. We'll get to that when those issues arise, and those issues almost certainly will arise. We've got another question over here. I know we're in early days in terms of seeing how the order from yesterday will be utilized in pending matters where there are parallel state and federal cases. But do you suspect that issuer defendants with appropriate pre-existing provisions in place will seek to revisit dismissal on that basis, even when the state cases are procedurally further along than the federal matters? Bill?
I guess my reaction would be, why not? I mean, it may depend on the particular circumstances, what procedural posture they're in, and sort of, you know, reading the particular jurist. But my first reaction would be to think about trying to make that motion dismiss based on this decision.
If you look at the cost benefit, trivially easy, relatively cheap to just file a motion to dismiss, cite to the recent opinion in Shabakuki. And the worst thing that happens is your ability to negotiate a better settlement increases, you know, very significantly. So, you know, from that perspective, at least the way I look at it, there's all upside, no downside, to doing anything of that sort. Which then brings us to, all right, the court's observation with regard to federal forum provisions, relatively recent phenomenon. And it just shows the utility basically of something that basically of the federal forum provision. And that then brings us to the famous Venn diagram. It is, as Bill and I like to say, designed for the visual learners amongst us. And it tries to lay out the different types of scope corporate, intra-corporate, and other forms of claims. So, Bill, why don't we start with a conversation about the deepest blue on the left, sort of the core internal affairs, as Vice Chancellor Chandler derived them from first principles?
No, wait a minute. Don't accuse me of that. It's Vice Chancellor.
Oh, I'm sorry, Vice Chancellor Laster. Excuse me. Oh God, I'm going to owe you a beer now. Excuse me. And you were never. And you were Chancellor. All right.
I was both. Yeah. I was both at one point.
You were both.
But I think
exactly
that
right.
The darker blue of the, you know, diagram is, I think, the Court of Chancery's conception of what the internal affairs doctrine covers or should include, or what its scope is based on the invocation of first principles. And I think that was the the template for what the vice chancellor thought was the scope of 102B1, that is, and 109. This is the extent to which you can include provisions in your charter or your bylaws. It's only to the extent that they're covered or governed by Delaware law or Delaware policies. And that's the brighter blue ellipsis.
Well, I'll be candid with you, Bill. I read this part of the opinion, and I wasn't entirely 100% sure exactly what it means. And I'm going to have to go over this a few more times to try to figure out how to parse the language in a way that is sort of intuitively more clear to me. And I have a partial concern about that horizontal axis, the points A, B, and C. All right. And let me just raise that concern right now. And it was also implied in an earlier question. If the court means to say that the scope of internal affairs only covers the first two eggs, right, from A to B, then if it's saying that the federal forum provisions are intra-corporate affairs covered by 102B1, but they're not within the traditional scope of internal affairs, then don't we have a problem? Then couldn't California come along and say the internal affairs doctrine doesn't apply and we can therefore regulate this? You see my issue? I have an answer to that, but I don't know that this graphic really helps.
Yeah, I'm not sure, Joe. I think they were trying just to illustrate that the scope of 102 is broader than internal affairs, that when you read the text of 102, it can incorporate the management of the business and the conduct of its affairs in a way that it is in excess of what are the internal corporate claims that are defined in 115. Yes. That's what I thought they were trying to get at. But I see the conundrum you're describing.
Exactly. And you know, I don't know if they made a mistake in doing the Venn diagram, if they didn't think about this or what have you. But I look at this Venn diagram, and as I try to absorb, and so what I'm trying to do is, and if anybody on the call has any good ideas, please email us. I'm trying to address the following question. If we want to avoid litigation as to whether federal forum provisions are covered by the internal affairs doctrine and only Delaware can regulate them, then this Venn diagram may be problematic, because if federal forum provisions fit into the intra-corporate affairs section, which sits between B and C, then it's easy for someone to interpret this Venn diagram as saying, well, that's okay then, because California can regulate it. It's not covered by internal affairs, and Delaware Supreme Court has said so, which is not what I think they said.
I don't think that is right, Joe. I think the point was just that the internal affairs doctrine covers the classic claims under Delaware law, but that the intra-corporate affairs, the part of the egg between B and C, is still part of the intra-corporate relationships between directors and officers and stockholders that's governed by 102 and by all the other provisions of the Delaware General Corporation Law, and that all of those are subject to the sovereign that created the entity and who established that law,
right,
regulating that.
Now, that's terrific. So what you're saying is that the internal affairs doctrine should go out to point C, and only Delaware can regulate to point C on the horizontal axis. And I agree with that. And I would be comforted if that point were made more clear in the opinion, and if that dotted line was a solid line, and if the text below covered the whole distance from A to C. All right.
Well, to do that, Joe, I think all you have to do is move the vertical line B out to C, and
yeah,
don't stop it.
Right.
And
but
then
the point is,
I think,
I can't rewrite the Delaware Supreme Court opinion. It's, you know, we can have
a
separate.
Well, you've tried.
I'm sorry?
You in the past, you have tried from time to time.
Oh, yeah. And I've occasionally had more success than I deserve. But this, let's put it this way. This raises an ambiguity that could spawn litigation in the future. And I think it would be great if we could figure out how to get rid of that.
All right. Let me think about it.
All right. Here's another question. Does the Federal Arbitration Act preclude the application of Section 115 to a mandatory arbitration clause? There's the boom question. What do you think, Bill?
I think it's a very good question. I don't know if I have the answer to that. I've heard this before. There might be a problem with that. I don't know.
Yeah. So I'm going to answer that question directly, indirectly, in the following sense. The real problem with getting a mandatory arbitration provision in is getting it through the SEC. The staff will not grant acceleration if you have a mandatory arbitration provision, and they use their Section 8A authority and, in effect, say, look, we think this is against the public interest because you're not going to be litigating this in open court. And the Federal Arbitration Act, in my view, does not override the SEC's ability to make these judgments about the public interest. So the real bulwark as a practical matter against the application of the FAA to these provisions is the judgment of the SEC with regard to acceleration in connection with Section 8A. If push ever comes to shove, the way it'll happen is the way it's happened in the past. Somebody's going to put in a registration statement. It'll have a mandatory arbitration provision. The SEC will say, well, we're not accelerating. Then what are you going to do? Are you going to litigate it? Because if you litigate it, you're not going public. And in a real world sense, that may be the blockage there. We have another question. Wouldn't anything not including the external affairs egg technically be internal affairs? And isn't the opposite of external internal?
Well, there's the answer to your conundrum, Joe.
Yes. It's exactly right. But it would be better, in my view, if you had a solid line from B to C. All right. And if you made clear that only Delaware can regulate anything that is blue. Other states regulate the white, Delaware only the blue. Just a second. So as we look ahead, all right, there are a couple of things that I think are almost perfectly predictable. We know that for any corporation that has a federal forum provision or has one as of the time they're sued under Section 11, there's going to be litigation on an as-applied basis. We've already had that question. I think Bill and I are of the view that it's hard to imagine a state policy that would stop litigation of a federal claim in federal court. And if a court does go off the rails that way, I hope it'll go to the United States Supreme Court. And I hope everybody's intuitive understanding of the internal affairs doctrine would prevail. Second point, federal forum bylaws, they're coming. The opinion, in my view, is almost an invitation to adopt them. And I would think that you might as well put them in place now, even if you're not contemplating an offering, who knows? All right, you may do a follow-on, and why take the risk of forgetting it? There's no downside. The other point that people should consider is in any publicly traded debt, to the extent that you can place in an indenture or other relevant documentation the equivalent of a federal forum provision, that's something you should definitely consider. And also in the designation of preferences of any preferred shares or the like, basically anything that is publicly traded, in my view, should come with a document a governing document, an organic document that requires that these Section 11 claims go to federal court, not to state court. Then there's the possibility of tinkering with the language of these federal forum provisions. Bill, you and I have seen various articulations of this. Would you like to describe some of the ones you've seen and some of the issues that they raise?
Well, just generally, I've seen some where they picked or selected particular federal courts to send the claims to, and they've been upheld, or the ones I've seen have been upheld. But I tend to think, Joe, that it's probably not necessary to do that. I think mostly these cases are going to find their way into the federal court that has the proper venue anyway. So it doesn't seem to me to be a fight worth picking to try to pick individual or specific federal courts. And the provisions that you've used in these and that we defended in these cases were all general and would allow any federal district court for a plaintiff to file in. So that's my take on it. Is it really worth fighting over? And I don't think it is.
No, I agree entirely. I mean, there are other provisions out there that say, for example, not that it'll be brought in federal court, but it'll be brought in the district court in the District of Massachusetts. They get that precise. I don't think you need that, because given federal venue law, you're going to wind up in your headquarters jurisdiction anyway. That's how the litigation pretty much plays out. Constraining it that way may not be viewed favorably by, you know, any of the courts that have to rule on what's going on here. And if I were to tweak the language, Kathy Dearlove, who also litigated this matter, you know, her suggestion is, well, you know, maybe you just stick in an additional clause that makes clear that plaintiffs have the ability to bring the claim in Delaware state court. I don't see any harm to that. And, you know, from my perspective, it's six of one, half dozen of the other, because the fiduciary out also gives the ability to consent to Delaware. I view that more as a matter of taste rather than a matter of what actually has to be done. Is that consistent with your view, Bill?
Yeah, we talked about that, and Kathy did suggest that, and I agree with it. And it is consistent, Joe, with your advice on a lot of things, which is it's like chicken soup. It can't hurt.
Exactly. Again, a huge thanks to Bill and to Priya and to the team at Cornerstone. Bill, Priya, any other questions, comments, or observations?
Not from me, Joe. I appreciate being on with you and being with Priya. Really appreciate the invitation, Sasha. I'm going to have to drop, unfortunately, but I always enjoy being with you, Joe, and hope to see you soon when we're through this mess that we're in right now.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Joe, I want to thank both you and Bill. This outcome could not have happened without your hard work. And I know it was a labor of love, because I know you both, but still, it's a mighty lift, and it's a wonderful outcome. One of the things that I'll mention is that I think very often people think of the Section 11 problem and all this litigation as in some way limited to IPO companies. And just as a reminder, we have seen a few mature public companies be sued in state court on registration statements in connection with M&A. I know, Joe, you and I have discussed that this is an area ripe for invention and innovation by the very clever plaintiffs bar. And so, you know, I am hopeful that we will start to see public companies think about the steps they want to take, Delaware-listed public companies think about the steps they want to take to protect themselves with federal forum provisions. I don't think this is just an IPO company problem at all.
All right. We have two other questions. We've got a question. I understand the SEC has required companies to include risk disclosures relating to forum selection bylaws, charter provisions arising from Chancery's decision. Any sense of where the SEC will be going on this? You know, my view is, now that we have the opinion from the Delaware Supreme Court, you're going to wind up seeing disclosures that will be essentially equivalent to those relating to intra-corporate forum selection provisions. Delaware has spoken. That's the last word. I think the commission will say, yeah, parallel disclosures explaining how this works. That'll be fine. Another question, the opinion cites my article for the proposition that a Section 11 claim must necessarily, quote, arise from the purchase of shares as opposed to share ownership. No elaboration on this, such as an example. Do we have to read your article, or can you give an example of such? No, it would be cruel and unusual to force anybody to read anything that I've written. So stipulated. And this article, way too long. I mean, in TypeScript, it was like 95 pages, 475 footnotes. My goal was to explain why Chancellor was wrong in fewer than 100 pages, in fewer than 500 footnotes. And that was a challenge because it was so wrong on so many different levels. A simple answer to the question. If you look at Section 11, you have to be a purchaser of the shares. You have to demonstrate that you purchase. And then if you acquire in the aftermarket, you also have to be able to trace under those circumstances. Simply being a stock owner would be insufficient. We are essentially at the end of our time.